This week's episode of SciPod is sponsored by IBM.
Hello, I'm Caroline Williams in London.
Hello, I'm Ivan Semenek in Boston.
And this is SciPod, the international science podcast from New Scientist magazine.
This week on the June 23rd edition of SciPod, got a minute? According to the latest research, you only have about three of them before your next interruption. Researchers investigate our increasingly distracted working lives.
Branching out, how did the Amazon come to be the epitome of biodiversity? New evidence suggests a long-held theory is headed for the woodpile.
Live wire. In research news, scientists create a new type of pacemaker grown directly from a patient's own cells.
And how fat do you have to be bulletproof? We tackle another weighty question in this week's installment of The Last Word. SciPod. It's not just a podcast, it's information of the highest caliber.
It's the curse of the modern working world. Some days life is just an endless stream of interruptions. Even the technology that's designed to help us, email, wireless internet, and text messaging, seems to be hindering our ability to get things done. But can we tame the technology and create a more sensible working environment? This week, New Scientist takes a closer look at the phenomenon of interruptions and the experts who study it. So drop what you're doing. Here's a story worth paying attention to.
Of course, everyone says they have too many interruptions. After all, who's going to say they have too few? Dr. Gloria Mark is an associate professor of informatics at the University of California, Irvine. She wanted to know how much people were really getting interrupted at work. Here's what she found out.
Well, it's actually far worse than I had imagined. So what we did was we timed the events that people did throughout the day. And an event could be a telephone call, someone entering your cubicle, typing on a Word document, and we measured the start and stop time for all of these events. And we did this for 36 people. Each person measured 3 days. And we found out that each person on the average switches tasks or is interrupted every 3 minutes.
Now, 3 minutes is not a lot of time in which to accomplish anything. But there's more bad news. Mark also found that while it's easy to get distracted from your work, just try getting back to it.
It's not that people are interrupted and then go right back to work, but they work on an average of two different topics before going back to work, and it takes them an average of about 23 minutes to resume an interrupted task. By then, their desktop environment has changed, their physical environment has changed, and it's very hard for them to get the cognitive cues that they need in order to resume work quickly.
And all of these interruptions take their toll. It's not just that we're getting less accomplished in a given period of time. According to Mark, this atmosphere of endless interruption actually changes what we can accomplish.
I believe that this impacts innovations, because I don't think people have sufficient amount of time to really think deeply about what they're doing. So this comes more from the qualitative interviews and qualitative research that we did, and I've spoken to a number of people, and they claim that they just don't have the length of time that they need to really get involved in a problem, to really think it through, you know, to find a satisfying solution. They basically are just reacting to the demands of their environment to get things done.
But don't lose hope just yet. Mark's research suggests that not all interruptions are equal. Some may even help us to be more productive. In fact, she found that about half of all the interruptions her subjects faced were self-imposed. They literally stopped what they were doing and started something else for no apparent reason. This suggests that the role interruptions play in the way we work is not black and white. The key is context. Mark's research shows that people tend to work within different cognitive spheres. In her view, the best kinds of interruptions are those that keep you within your current sphere, but stimulate your thinking.
That means if you're working on some project and you're interrupted with exactly the same context, my hypothesis is that this would be beneficial, would actually help people. If it's causing people to have to make a very strong shift, like a cognitive shift, to some other topic, then it's going to be detrimental.
The trick is how to screen out the detrimental interruptions, but let the good ones in. And this problem has a technological dimension, because Mark's study also showed that people now spend more time with their computers than ever. It's both the place where they work on projects and interact with others via email. This dual function means it's very easy for the computer to become the source of distraction. But here's where smarter software can come to the rescue. Eric Horvitz is principal researcher at Microsoft Research, and his email works a little differently from what you may be used to.
Now, the kind of tools that I work with daily include methods that automatically sift through email and that assign scores or which refer to the urgency of me seeing that message. So one of these scores we call the expected cost of delayed review, which gets assigned to each incoming email message into my inbox. And so when I get back to my office, I can just glance up at a little glowing display. It's kind of faded out so it doesn't get in the way too much, and I can get a sense for, of all the unread email that I have, which are the most urgent ones that I need to act on.
The prototype system Horvitz is using also knows when he's away from his computer and can predict how long it will be before he's likely to return. Then, as emails come in, it decides which of them are worth passing on to Horvitz wherever he happens to be.
For many of us, this is true for me, it's giving me a sense of comfort in that if I don't receive anything while I'm out in the world, I know that my system has decided, based on my own preferences and its learnings from me by watching me work with email over time, that everything else can wait till later.
For Horvitz, the system removes the anxiety many of us experience when we don't check our email frequently, and so it releases him from the need to interrupt himself too much or to make himself too available. The email is just the beginning. A far more reaching development at Microsoft is an experimental tool called Life Browser. It keeps track of virtually everything you do and helps maintain the context that keeps you working productively.
And it's beyond staying on track. It's really these tools can really give you a sense of identity and an autobiography. I have to say that whenever I bring up Life Browser here, which I'm looking at right now on my desktop, I almost fall off my chair with excitement that, you know, it gives me a real sense for what's been happening. And there are some sliders that can slide more or less detail or more or less memorability along photograph dimension of photographs, appointments, and work. That helps me recover context and get back into, even after a distracting meeting on a different topic, I can sort of dive back in and recover kind of a context as to how I was working recently.
Depending on how optimistic you are, the future could be very bright indeed, with software that better meshes with human psychology, reduces unwanted interruptions, and maintains the context of what we're doing. From Gloria Mark's point of view, that's a big step in the right direction. But there's a long way still to go. And while the means to fewer interruptions may involve cutting-edge technology, the ultimate goal is about as human as it gets.
Yes, I think to be able to enable people to have less stressful and more productive work lives, and especially to achieve what's called the state of flow, where you can really enjoy what you're doing without being distracted, and to really feel like you've got the time to accomplish more.
Gloria Mark is currently on sabbatical in Germany. During our recording of this story, she was repeatedly interrupted by her daughter practicing flute. Eric Horowitz at Microsoft had to postpone his appointment with us because of another urgent matter, but he was able to join us exactly half an hour later. And we are ever so glad that you were able to make time for us here at SciPod.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
If you've never heard of Duck Lake, don't worry. It's too small to show up on most maps, and it's too remote for tourists. But deep in its murky waters lies the evidence that's transforming our understanding of biodiversity in the Amazon rainforest. Adrian Barnett is a tropical ecologist with Roehampton University in London. In the current issue of New Scientist, he documents the revolution taking place in the world's most prolific ecosystem. We reached him this week in Mountain View, California.
Adrian, as a scientist, you've done a lot of fieldwork yourself in the rainforests of Amazonia. It's widely recognized to be a rich, biologically diverse ecosystem. Can you paint a picture for us of what that biodiversity really means when you're standing there? You know, for those who haven't been, how is that richness experienced?
Well, I mean, it's very different from anything you've ever experienced before. I mean, it really is super abundant, but in a particularly strange way. I think, you know, TV programs and so forth are rather misleading. You expect to see, you know, jaguars sort of creeping past every limb and the place to be absolutely chock full of monkeys and stuff. And they're there, but they're often quite difficult to see. The most abundant diversity is generally in insects, and you see that kind of thing. If you put a lamp out at night next to, let's say, a sheet or something like that, it'll be covered with an extraordinary diversity of quite beautiful moths and things like that and other insects very, very quickly. And then you realize, you know, just how diverse things are. That really does sort of bring it home.
So that's a wonderful image of what it's like. Now, one of the key scientific questions that underlies this incredible place is, how did the rainforest get to be so diverse? It seems like the answer to that question is changing, and it's changing because of new evidence that comes from places like Duck Lake. So first of all, tell us, where is Duck Lake, and what is there that can tell us about the story of life in the Amazon?
Well, yeah, Duck Lake is a very unusual little lake. When you're actually working in the Amazon, occasionally, if you're flying over it, you will see small mountains. These are very, very old, very resilient rocks. And on the top of them, there are often these very small lakes. And if you want to study the history of the Amazon, these are the places you've got to go, because they will contain an untrammeled sedimentological record. You can drill down into the bottom of these things, and you will get sediment that hasn't been messed about by the passage of rivers. If you start looking at lakes in the lowland Amazon areas, well, you know, you will have had a big river, and in the past it would have whooshed one way and then it would have whooshed back the other way, and all the sediment, all the pollen that might have been deposited would have got all churned up and won't actually tell you very much. But these little lakes sitting on the top of these quite isolated rocky hills have never been whooshed about, messed about with rivers. They've just been gently tinkled at by small streams that are bringing in pollen, and also by rain that's basically washing pollen into them.
Now, I want to ask you about what that pollen record is telling us. But first, you know, can you sketch out for us the traditional explanation for the Amazon's biodiversity? You know, the explanation that was present before people were looking at this pollen record and which may now be overturned. What's the kind of the old school picture of how biodiversity came to be?
Well, in the very old school idea, sort of the 19th century idea, was that there was an awful lot of it. There it was. It was diverse and it was splendid, and it was sort of uniformly magnificent everywhere. And then people like Wallace and Bates started chugging up rivers and keeping detailed notes, and they realized that it wasn't the same everywhere. There were some species occurred in some places and some species didn't occur in others. And that information gradually got built up and built up and built up until in the 1960s, people like Jürgen Hafer, who was a paleontologist and paleontologist, but also a petroleum biologist and also a fanatical birder. He was going around and recording where, when he was doing his petroleum explorations, he saw different types of toucans, and he realized that he was seeing them in clusters. He was not seeing them everywhere. They were quite defined where they were. And he proposed the idea of refugia, and the notion went like this. It was that in the past... the climate had been much drier elsewhere in the world, because it had been much colder, because you'd had ice ages and that had sucked up all the moisture, and that had lain there invested in big glaciers. Suddenly there was much less rain, and well, the effect for that in the Amazon was that whilst it still was warm, it was actually a lot drier, and so the forest had contracted and stayed just in those specially moist bits, you know, maybe near a mountain, or maybe near some other wet place where there was going to be a sort of a climatological eddy and you had lots of precipitation. And so it didn't look like it does now with this great big green swathe, but it looked very, very patchy and nibbled at. And the animals that lived in the forest would have just stayed there, and gradually over time, where these forests were basically habitat islands, they would have become isolated, and just like real islands, like the Galapagos, the species would have become slightly different. And then when the forest rejoined, when the climate got moister again, they would sort of look at each other and go, well, I don't think you're going to mate with you anymore. Look, you've got a green chest and I've got a blue one. And so you had speciation through isolation.
So the story that this spins out effectively is we start with something that is a rich, tropical environment. The ice age arrives. There's less moisture. The big tropical basin dries up into islands. This is where the speciation is really being driven by this, I guess, during the ice ages, and then it reconnects. To someone who has no training in this area, it sounds to me like a plausible model. So what's the problem with it?
Well, it was beautiful. Everybody liked it. It was really, a fascinating model, and everybody was extremely pleased with it. And there was a guy called Paul Colombo who noted that basically what Jürgen Hafer had done was very, very, very good science. I mean, he looked at the distribution of his toucans and other birds, and he proposed this idea, but he hadn't got the palynological data, the fossil pollen data, to prove it. But luckily enough, well, that was what Paul Colombo did. He looked at fossil pollen. So he was set up to test the theory. And over the last 30 years or so, he's been testing it, looking at Duck Lake and a number of other lakes sitting on top of these small mountains in the Amazon. And the thing that he finds is basically that the model doesn't work. Then the problem with it is that if you were going to have large amounts of areas that were not forest, then those areas would be things like grassland. Well, of course, it's grasslands. Grasses are wind dispersed, and you would expect them to be producing a very large amount of pollen. And so the lakes, these little fossil lakes, even if they didn't have grass right next to them, with so much grass pollen in the air, they should have some grass pollen in them. And the thing is that when Colombo and his colleagues look for this grass pollen, they don't find it at all.
So then if this ice age model isn't adequate, if it doesn't turn up in the pollen record in Duck Lake and in other places, how does others account for the diversity of the Amazon?
Yes, it's actually very interesting. It's become, it's almost showing the inadequacy of the very sort of simple predictive science, of the predictive nature of Jürgen Hafer's original model. It was a very, very beautiful, very elegant model. And as I think is perfectly true to say, Paul Colombo has thoroughly disproven the original idea. Well, people like Jürgen Hafer and people like Sir Gillian Prance, who's a very experienced old Amazonian botanist who used to be the director of Kew Gardens, they say, well, okay, fair enough. In that case, what about this? And they've looked at the data and said, well, if it wasn't grasses, it could well have been something else. It could have well have been scrubby. And they believe that at least in the eastern Amazon, that there was very scrubby, very thorny kind of sort of Mediterranean vegetation.
One thing that strikes me about the Refugia model, the original model, is that what it's talking about is geologically quite recent. You know, the ice ages are quite recent in the history of the planet. Could there be other things going on, much longer before that, that might also play a role, or where the hand of those earlier events might still be apparent in the diversity of the Amazon as well? Are people looking further back than the ice ages?
I think this is one of the key things that Paul Colombo has contributed, is a sense of deep time in the Amazon, because the records that he's been getting from Duck Lake are 180,000 years old, and most other places you can't get sediment records beyond about 5,000 years old. So, he's suddenly pushing back what people are looking at. And people, when they've been looking at mitochondrial DNA, have been finding that species did not speciate in the Pleistocene, did not all arise 10,000 years ago. It wasn't like there was a fairly dull, boring Amazon and suddenly, splat, 10,000 years ago, vast amounts of stuff suddenly starts zooming around in the forest. Looking at the mitochondrial DNA, which allows you a very good idea of when things arose, people are actually finding that things arose a lot earlier than that. And most species in the Amazon are not 10,000 years old, but at the very least 5 million.
So, Adrian, it may well be then that the origin of the diversity of the Amazon stretches back to a time well before the Ice Ages, but that does still beg the question, you know, if it happened at an earlier time, then what was the cause of it at that earlier time?
Well, actually, it's quite curious because, as you know, the South America and the Amazon that occurs within it is a very asymmetric continent, and it has a big chain of mountains running down the far left-hand side. And that's been actually chugging upwards for many, many, many millions of years. But between 11 and 5 million years ago, it underwent a particularly vigorous set of upthrustings. And that radically changed the way in which the rivers were flowing, and it caused sort of crustal crinkling, which formed these a whole load of little lakes across the surface of Amazonia, which again caused a lot of species to be isolated from each other. So this analysis is wonderful because it's become incredibly obvious that things are much more complex than previously people were aware. And for that, we have to thank Paul Collingbaugh very greatly because he upset the old apple cart, and we've now sort of, you know, looking at the situation anew. That's all the more wonderful and makes it all the more intriguing, and, you know, makes the forest even more fascinating and complex than, if it's possible, than it already was.
Well, it sounds like a fabulous place. Will you be going back yourself soon to work there?
I will indeed. I'm back down in August.
Well, we wish you well with your work, and thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
And you can find Adrian Barnett's story about rethinking the origins of biodiversity in the Amazon by leafing through the latest edition of New Scientist magazine. And now, this week's research news. American researchers have developed a replacement for artificial pacemakers that's grown from the patient's own cells. Implanted pacemakers cause problems in young children because a child's heart is still growing. That means doctors must repeatedly operate to keep the pacemaker attached to the right area. And those surgeries increase the chances of accidental damage. Douglas Cohen of the Children's Hospital in Boston, Massachusetts, is working on an alternative. His idea is to use the child's own cells to grow a living wire to take the place of a pacemaker.
So what we did is start doing some work in rats, and we used skeletal muscle cells called myoblasts, sort of a precursor cell, and mixed those up with collagen and some other ingredients into a mold, which created something that had sort of the consistency of maybe a gummy bear.
This gummy bear wire can then be implanted into the child's heart to conduct electrical signals between the upper and lower chambers, thus removing the need for a pacemaker. Because the wire would be made of the child's own cells, rejection by the body is not an issue. The hope is that such a wire would grow along with the child, thus avoiding risky surgeries. Cohen's next step is to engineer a small delay in the signals that pass between the chambers to simulate the rhythm of a natural heartbeat. The technique is described in the American Journal of Pathology. And finally, when a farmer looks to the sky, he can think ahead about how the weather will affect the ripening of his crop. When a grey-cheeked manga bee monkey looks to the sky, it thinks about pretty much the same thing. A scientist from the University of St Andrews in Scotland believes that she's witnessed these monkeys choosing when to gather fruit based on the weather. The monkeys must compete with all the other animals in the tropical forests of Uganda for figs and other fruit. With such fierce competition, it pays to arrive at a fig tree just as the fruit is becoming ripe. The study found that after visiting a fig tree and finding that the figs aren't yet ripe, monkeys are more likely to return to the tree if the weather gets warmer, which accelerates ripening. Other animals, such as geese and finches, are known to time their arrival at food sites based on the plant's natural cycles. But this is the first time scientists have seen an animal taking weather into consideration, much as a farmer would do. The result is reported in the journal Current Biology.
We hope you're enjoying this week's episode of SciPod, and we love hearing from you. In fact, last week we got a fair bit of feedback regarding our last word segment with Mick O'Hare. We'll talk about that in a moment, but meanwhile, if you've got a comment or question about this week's episode, it's easy to reach us. Just send your message to podcast@newscientist.com, and thanks again for listening.
And once again, it's time to dip into the ever-popular last word column, where New Scientist readers pose their most intriguing science questions, and where other readers vie for the chance to have the last word on the answers. Over 100 of these questions and answers are collected in the best-selling book, Does Anything Eat Wasps? Here's Ivan with last word editor, Mick O'Hare.
Mick O'Hare, thanks for joining us once again.
Hello, Ivan.
Mick, I know you have a new question for us this week, but first, we have issues to deal with from last week. As our listeners may recall, our question was, how do you weigh human head? And Mick, you gave us both a complicated and an easy method for doing this yourself at home. Can you remind us of what the easy method is, the do-it-yourself method?
Yeah, the easy method is I stick my head into a bucket of cold water and see how much splashes over the sides. Then we measure that volume.
Exactly. So the volume, you know, making an assumption there about the density of water and the density of your head. And you demonstrated this for us in the office to everyone's amusement. Now, we did make clear this is an approximation. Some of our listeners thought too much of an approximation. So here's an example. KT McGann of the Netherlands writes that assuming the density of the head is equivalent to water is quite a leap. Besides the bone and sinuses, which, of course, we did mention last week, the brain is made largely of lipids, which are significantly lower in density than water. So I think what this means is that you know, we can still preserve the method or the integrity of our method, but what we need is a material, clearly, Mick, that is of a density that's yet even closer to your head than water. So
I'm happy to put my head in it as long as I know what it is beforehand.
If we know what it is. So let's throw that out again to our listeners, which is what the last word is all about. So someone can come up with a material that's even closer in density, then we'll give it a go and see how much more accurate we can be. So now, Mick, you've got another question for us this week. What is this week's last word question?
This week's question is, how fat would you have to be bulletproof? So that's a bullet fired from an ordinary handgun. How fat would you have to be to stop it penetrating any vital organs?
Right. Now, I think at this point it's worth reminding everyone that these are not our questions. These are the questions that come from our readers, from New Scientist readers, and what a twisted group.
Yeah, we're not quite sure why they want to know that, but we're happy to answer.
Exactly.
It.
Yeah, so, and this is one of those classic questions that's drawn from the Does Anything Eat Wasps book. So, where do you start with a question like this? You know, how do you know how much fat it takes to stop a bullet?
I suppose the research is going to have been done somewhere. People know how much human flesh can be penetrated by a bullet fired at a certain distance. And you then have to work out how much fat a human would need to stop that bullet reaching their heart or their lungs or any other important organ.
This is a bit like the human head question in the sense that when you're doing this research, you still want to be able to walk out of the room.
Exactly. You either need a substance that mimics human fat or a very good computer model, I imagine.
So, and what kind of answers did readers come up with on this one?
Well, Thomas Lambert of Derbyshire in Britain, he said that you would probably need about 60 centimetres of human flesh before the bullet would stop. Now, what often happens is that a bone will get in the way and the bullet will stop a little bit quicker, but obviously that's going to hurt too.
Right.
So if it's just pure fat, you're going to need 60 centimetres, which is about 2 feet of human fat. Now that calculates up as high as 650 kilograms for a human being, which is obviously isn't much use to a human anyway, because you're not going to be particularly healthy at that weight.
Yeah, that's definitely an answer that you can't walk away
from. You can't walk away. You could shuffle into
anywhere.
Battle, but you probably couldn't run.
You know, the interesting thing is that here in the U.S., fast food and guns are so often considered as separate problems. But, you know, it you kind of think that maybe this question reminds us that maybe one is driving the other. If you can layer on those extra pounds to protect yourself. So it's surprising, though. I mean, it might be somewhat less than, you said 60 centimeters.
Yeah.
I guess that's based on studies that have been done with
well, it was a 9mm handgun round. I don't know much about guns, but the research was done with 9mm handgun, which is the most common type, apparently.
Right. And what are they firing into?
Well, you need a kind of viscous gel that mimics human flesh, and then you can check the penetration depth.
Right. And so this ballistics gel, I think it's also called ordnance gel. You know, as we're talking about this, it suddenly occurs to me, this is something that's meant to mimic the density of human fat. I don't know how that matches the density of human brains, but we might also have an answer to how to weigh the head here.
Yes.
So maybe we should order ourselves up a case of ballistics gel.
Does it stick?
Well, anyway, Mick, I think that's a kind of an interesting and shocking answer to how much you would have to weigh
to be bulletproof. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And that's it for this episode of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you'll find in the June the 24th issue of New Scientist magazine. Also this week, talking hot air. New evidence suggests that many countries who've signed the Kyoto Protocol are underreporting their emissions of greenhouse gases.
Dining with Death, a look at the perils of peanut allergies and the promise of new treatments currently heading for clinical trials.
And Let There Be Lightning, why a US researcher is planning to zap his way into the record books by building the largest lightning machine ever in the Nevada desert.
This week's edition of SciPod was brought to you by the staff and contributors of New Scientist magazine and NewScientist.com, which this week included Patrick Berry, Claire Bowles, Kate Douglas, Rowan Hooper, and Allison Motlop. Our technical production is by Bill Oxley, and our theme music was created and performed by The Damn Neighbors.
John McFarland is the executive producer of SciPod. I'm Caroline Williams.
And I'm Ivan Semenek. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
This week's episode of SciPod is sponsored by IBM.